Good evening, everyone. This is the second and final lecture on a great Camrosian, a truly great Camrosian, Chester Ronning. And I am grateful to the Ronning Center, and particularly to David Goa, for the opportunity to speak to you tonight about Ronning as diplomat. Chester Alvin Ronning died in Camrose the last day of December 1984, 18 days after his 90th birthday. Among those who gathered at his funeral were friends and admirers from Canada, the United States, and of course China. In his 90 years, Ronning touched many lives and accomplished many things. He was awarded the Alberta Order of Excellence, the highest award given by his home province, and was a Companion of the Order of Canada, the highest rank in the highest civilian award given by Canada. In 1983, to mark his 90th birthday, he was honored in Beijing with a banquet at the Great Hall of the People. Canadian newspaper, television, and radio commentators marked Ronning's passing as the death of a great man who during his life was a farmer, teacher, missionary, musician, sculptor, soldier, pilot, politician, and diplomat. Many failed to note one thing that was a great source of pride for Chester Ronning. He was born in China. His Chineseness was so apparent to his Chinese friends that some called him an egg. White outside, but yellow inside. One did not talk long with Chester Ronning before he referred to his birth at Fancheng, Hubei. With a smile, he would boast that he was the first non-Chinese baby born in Xiangyang County, and that he was nursed by a Chinese wet nurse. From the day of his birth, the 13th of December, 1894, Ronning's life was entwined with the history of China. Fate drew him back to the land of his birth at crucial times in its history. When he recalled his life, he invariably spoke of the history of China. Chinese was his first language, what he spoke growing up. He learned Norwegian from his parents, and later in the United States, he learned English. Ronning was trilingual by the time he was 15. Throughout his life, he used all three languages to great effect. It was his ability to communicate easily with people, along with his impish sense of humor and innate curiosity, that made him a natural teacher, politician, and diplomat. He preferred to gather knowledge firsthand through direct observation and by talking with people. By the time of Pearl Harbor, the 7th of December, 1941, Ronning's career in active politics was drawing to a close. Already in his late 40s, he had gathered a wide circle of friends and associates in his years as principal of Camrose Lutheran College and his time in politics. In addition, there were his friends and relatives bonded through membership in the Lutheran Church and by Norwegian origins. He was known in Western Canada and in the American states of Minnesota and Iowa. His father had accepted Canadian citizenship, but other members of Ronning's family, including siblings, were in the United States. In Norway were the families of his father and mother. Ronning was a tall tree and had prodigious roots. Those roots extended across the Pacific to China, to students and friends from his childhood and his days at the Hung Wan Red Wing School. All of these connections were important in the next phase of his career. But there was nothing among them to suggest that he was destined to become a diplomat, let alone an important and famous one. One connection was missing. Apart from the leaders of the federal CCF party, Ronning had no links to Ottawa, the hub of Canadian diplomacy. The Canadian Foreign Office, known as the Department of External Affairs, was founded in 1909 and did not have any members, had many members by 1940. It was staffed by very intelligent persons, among them Rhodes scholars. It was exclusively male. Canada's diplomacy frequently depended upon the British Foreign Office. Apart from an embassy in Japan, Canada's representation abroad was confined to Europe and America. The Department of External Affairs had little experience relating to Asia. If it needed advice on China, it tended to turn to returned Canadian missionaries or their children, many of whom were resident in and around Toronto. Canada sent many missionaries to China, perhaps more per capita than any other Western country. The Protestant missionary effort was headquartered in southern Ontario and the Catholic one in Quebec. Methodists and Presbyterian missionaries, these two churches later became the United Church, took up missions in the area around Guangzhou, which is Canton, in Sichuan around Chengdu, in Taiwan, and in north central China. Anglican missionaries were also active north of the Yangtze. These missionaries were to be an important factor in Canada's China policy. For example, among the first ambassadors from Canada to China after 1970, three were sons of Protestant missionaries. In 1942, as allies in the war against Japan, Canada and China exchanged representatives. It's perhaps not well known that Canada declared war on Japan before the U.S. did. It was Canada's first embassy ever in China, although Canadian trade commissioners were stationed there before 1900. In 1942, the Department of External Affairs searched for a suitable person to be Canada's first ambassador to China. It sought the advice of many people, including Pearl Buck and the missionary community in and around Toronto. They received suggestions, offers from a number of missionaries eager to fill the post. The department was advised to select someone who was familiar with Asia, spoke Chinese, of a non-military background, and not from British Columbia. It chose, with major assistance from Prime Minister Mackenzie King, a retired general and a former Liberal politician from British Columbia, Victor Wentworth Odlum. Odlum, a bit of a martinet, was called rum snitcher and pea super by his troops in the First World War because he deprived them of their rum rations. He was called back to duty in Britain in the late 30s, but he proved to be so out of step with military life that the Canadian government was asked to relieve him of military responsibilities. Looking for a face-saving solution, Mackenzie King appointed him High Commissioner to Australia. He had not been there long before he was asked to go to the Chinese wartime capital of Chongqing. Odlum was later raised to the rank of ambassador in the fall of 1943. His embassy was small, and Odlum considered the junior offers to be beneath his attention. He desperately needed a senior officer with China experience to whom he could talk and from whom he could get advice. In 1942, Ronning was virtually unknown in Ottawa, nor was he known among Canadian missionaries. His father had become Canadian after he had served as a Lutheran missionary in an American mission in China. In 1942, however, the Canadian government, looking for persons with facility in Asian languages, recommissioned Ronning as a flight lieutenant in the Royal Canadian Air Force, in which he had served briefly in World War I, and asked him to head up an intelligence unit assigned the task of cracking Japanese wartime codes. Ronning moved to Ottawa, where he worked for 3 years until VJ Day. In the 2 years before his family joined him, he lived in the Y, 80s meals out, often at a local Chinese restaurant. He had little time for sightseeing, but he did attend the House of Commons on occasion. Ottawa during the war was a very close-knit society, and Ronning rapidly became known to other members of the civil service and to those who had Asia experience, among them E.H. Norman of the Department of External Affairs. Norman, a brilliant scholar, was born in Japan and had written an exceptional work on Japanese history. He served as an advisor to General Douglas MacArthur in occupied Japan later on, but his life ended tragically. As Ronning put down roots in Ottawa, he retained those in Camrose. He was still the principal, on leave, of Camrose Lutheran College. When home on furloughs, he lectured to classes on the situation in Asia. In absentia, he was chosen a CCF candidate for the Camrose constituency to contest the June 1945 federal election. He did well, but not well enough. His quest for elected public office over, he was open to new challenges. Shortly before VJ Day, August 1945, Ronning was asked to assess the language skills of potential candidates for posting to the Canadian Embassy in China. With Japan's collapse, Canada was anxious to increase its diplomatic capacity in China. Ronning interviewed three candidates and found them to be Sorry. Sticky fingers. Below standard. He was asked to write, he found them to be below standard. He was asked to write the exam himself and was hired for the job. It was an extraordinary invitation. Ronning was 51, an age when most diplomats were in mid-career, and he was not a Rhodes Scholar. Moreover, the department's policy was to hire generalists, but Ronning was engaged because of his knowledge of China and of the Chinese language. He was given the rank of first secretary to take into account his previous career and the fact he was a war veteran. Little did anyone know that he was destined to have a diplomatic career of major importance in Canada's relations with Asia. In November 1945, Ronning, the new first secretary, arrived in Chongqing. Following an arduous 15-day journey from Canada that involved 70 hours on airplanes, all of them propeller-driven. The final leg was over the famous hump, the graveyard of dozens of aircraft and their brave crews. The Canadian embassy was rat-infested. The staff was small, and Ambassador Odlum was at odds with most of them. They all lived in a noisy compound full of young babies, dogs, and crowing roosters on Ferry Grotto Street. Between the rats and the noise, little sleep was to be had. Chongqing, although far up the Yangtze in southwest China, was not out of the range of Japanese bombers. But the almost constant cloud and haze covering that area reduced the damage. The city was crowded with foreigners, mainly Americans, waiting for the war to be over and the Chinese capital to return to Nanking, much nearer to China's eastern coast. The nature and quality of the life in Chongqing is ably described in a book by Graham Peck entitled Two Kinds of Time. The book itself has an interesting history. It was published in 1950, just as the influence of Senator McCarthy and the China lobby began to peak in the debate over who lost China. Peck's book was seized, pulped, and the plates destroyed. Copies are rare, and I'm pleased to read you a few passages from the one I own. Peck was an artist with pen, drawings, and words. Here is what Ronning flew into. My impression of those last days in Chongqing was of people bound on journeys whose end they did not know. The great holiday parades were compulsory affairs with every civic unit ordered to supply marchers. In the apathy of people who had not the slightest idea what they were doing, the celebrants would shamble along, raising their fists and shouting the slogans only when they were told to. On a drizzly afternoon shortly after the New Year, I saw the Generalissimo, this is Chiang Kai-shek, the leader, for the first time as he was speeding through the city to address a mass meeting of soldiers waiting in the mud of the commercial airfield in the Yangtze. As always, he traveled in one of the cavalcades of big black cars, the others packed with attendants and guards. His own car had dark blue curtains drawn over the back windows to hide sheet metal, I was told. And he was dimly visible as a rigid figure in the center of the back seat. When the first car of his suite came speeding through the traffic, the people walking and loitering in the road hurried to the sidewalk. While a limousine of their leader passed bounding smoothly over the uneven pavement like a big black panther, they took their umbrellas from over their heads and held them against their ankles to protect themselves from the sheets of filth fanning out from the wheels. As the holidays were consummated, strange sounds came from the compartments on both shores of the Yangtze. On the fore and south bank, the greatest parties were cooperative Saturday night affairs, Dutch treat suppers and dances held in one of the big oil company houses. Every man who brought liquor was a host, but the official hostess in charge of marshalling the food was another European wanderer who might as well be called Grusha, though her own name for herself was Goddess of Love. In happy tribute to the fact that men greatly outnumbered women in the foreign colony. Grusha's planning ability was nearly as erratic as her English, and when the guests had arrived laden with bottles, it was usually proved that there was nothing solid to eat except a few plates of peanuts and fried lotus root. But Grusha tremendously enjoyed her role as hostess and played it in a grand manner. "So glad you dropped," she would greet new arrivals at the head of the stairs. "I hope you're enjoying our little Dutch supper," she would graciously remark later as a party of guests charged up the stair with buckets of water to put out the rug, and the servants hastened in to report that a Mexican gentleman had fallen into the garden on his head. Over in the city, the immense crowds conscripted to attend patriotic meetings stood meekly before podiums decorated with fir branches and paper flowers. On the platforms, the men who were driving this huge land into its darkening future sweated as they bellowed their seasonal noises. It is the leader's moral duty to lead. It's the people's moral duty to obey. On the south bank, the outlanders who reported Chungking to the rest of the world had other interests. One Saturday afternoon, when the weekly party was gathering momentum and some of the senior diplomats were still present with their pomp and circumstance, Grusha made her first entrance. Another of her favorite friends, Bob, was sitting in a chair near the door. "Oh, Bob," she cried, leaning over, throwing her arms around his head, gathering in. As the whole room fell silent to savor her arrival, "You are the friend of my heart. I press you to my bottom." Those who were standing nearby reported later that a frantic mouth had been seen projecting from under her bust. "Bosom, for God's sake," it muttered. "Bosom, bosom, bosom." It's unlikely Ronning attended any of these parties, as he was under the watchful eye of Ambassador Odlum. Odlum, a general, greatly admired Chiang Kai-shek and was working on proposals for Canada-China cooperation following the war. Whenever he met Chinese communist leaders, he advised them to cooperate with Chiang and to accept his leadership. The two junior officers on Odlum's staff, both knowledgeable about Asia, were left unconsulted. Ronning was closer in age to Odlum, and like Odlum, had served in the armed forces in both world wars. Ronning recognized Odlum as every inch the soldier, and Odlum recognized Ronning as a member of his embassy holding high enough rank to be consulted and to be trusted to act as his interpreter. Ronning arrived just in time to observe negotiations between Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong, between Yan'an, the communist headquarters, and Chongqing, the nationalist capital, at the behest of the Americans. Through Ronning, courtesy of Wang Bingnan of the Yan'an Information Office, the Canadian embassy was kept up to date on the progress of the negotiations. During this time, Ronning met people on both sides of the civil conflict and made friendships that would endure through his life. He shared his experiences through letters to his family, which were published or summarized in the pages of the Camrose Canadian. A little Chinese history is needed here to provide some context. Ronning had last been in China in 1927. At that time, he and his family were advised by the British to return to Canada in view of the violence and unrest that accompanied the Northern Expedition. The Northern Expedition was a combined effort of the Nationalists and the Communists, led by Chiang Kai-shek. The alliance between the two parties was uneasy and had been brokered by Moscow and Sun Yat-sen in 1923. The Northern Expedition was conceived of by Sun Yat-sen as a means of putting an end to the reign of the warlords and of uniting the Republic. He died in 1925 before his dream was realized, and Chiang Kai-shek took his place. Once the Northern Expedition reached Shanghai and the Yangtze in 1927, the agreement between the two parties came apart. Chiang and the Nationalists triumphed and established their capital at Nanjing. The communists were driven to the hills, where they eventually made Mao Zedong their leader. Chiang was now without Moscow's support, and he turned to Germany for military advisors, people who later became very famous under the Nazis. He attempted to eliminate the communists through bombing raids on their mountain retreat. He nearly succeeded, but a number of the communists slipped away and launched on the epic long march that saw them emerge after a year at the dusty northwestern town of Yan'an, where they lived in caves. They were relatively few in numbers, but the long march gave them a sense of invincibility and of the inevitability of victory. With Japan's encroachment on northern China, the communists engaged in guerrilla warfare, winning propaganda victories among Chinese peasants and intellectuals. Jiang and the nationalists, meanwhile, evacuated the capital of Nanjing to move up the Yangtze River to Chongqing. They moved not only the government, but industries and educational institutions as well. They attempted to continue the harassment of the communists, but with little success. The revolt of a pro-Jiang warlord at Xi'an in 1936 forced the nationalists and communists once again to cooperate, at least in the fight against Japan. With Pearl Harbor, America entered the scene and, through military advisors, attempted to strengthen nationalist forces to fight Japan. But instead, Jiang was concentrating on the civil war against the communists, which was bound to come after Japan's defeat. The Americans, however, were anxious to bring the two sides together and to fashion in China a bastion of Western-style democracy. It was these negotiations that Ronning was in time to observe. In Chongqing, he met Zhou Enlai and his wife, Deng Yingqiao, and acted as interpreter for Odlum at dinners that occasioned major discussions. Odlum pressed his plan for China's future, and Zhou Enlai countered with the comment that Odlum, coming from a different background, did not fully appreciate the situation. Zhou's interpreter was Zhang Wenjin, who became China's second ambassador to Canada in the early 1970s. On his flight into Chongqing, Ronning had met Dung Bi-Wu, a senior communist theoretician, and his interpreter Chang Han-Fu. He learned of the animosity between the Soviets and the Chinese communists. Within a very brief period, Ronning met individuals who within 5 years became prominent members of the new government. In the spring of 1946, Ronning oversaw the move of the Canadian embassy to Nanjing, not an easy task. Space was at a premium because of the destruction in the war, and many countries were competing for houses. Moreover, the streets were full of demobilized Japanese soldiers waiting to go back home. In Nanjing, Ronning began to meet the leaders of the nationalist government, relocated from Chongqing. He met Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek and his wife, Sung Mei-ling, who was American-educated and was said to have converted her husband to Methodism. He also met H.H. Kung, a banker, a direct descendant of Confucius, and Zhang's brother-in-law. Ronning recorded his views of Kung. Quote, "Old H.H. was truly a Chinese gentleman of the old, old order. Can China afford them today? I must agree with the communists. No. China must be modernized to end the misery, poverty, and corruption and skullduggery suffered by the masses who sustained this luxury and culture for the wealthy, privileged few. China can no longer afford old H.H. Kung's." A constant theme in Ronning's diplomatic career was his family. He had been in China for a year without them. He had to put pressure on the Department of External Affairs to keep their promise that if he stayed on, they would make sure his wife would join him. He celebrated the New Year in 1947 with the arrival of his wife and children, and in May, the new ambassador, T.C. Davis, replacing Odlum, who had left the previous November, presented his credentials to the national government. Davis, formerly a judge, like Odlum, was previously an elected politician and high commissioner to Australia. He was liberal in outlook and much easier to work with. He arrived in a time to see the civil war in China gather momentum and to watch the nationalist government collapse in the face of rampant corruption and mega inflation. By November 1948, Ronning had been in China for 3 years without leave. He proposed that he return to Canada with his family, who had been ordered to depart in view of the deteriorating situation. Inga, Ronning's wife, insisted that he return. But when Ottawa promised that if he stayed, he would be made ambassador to Norway in the future, Inga withdrew her objection. "My wife seemed to think I was just as dispensable as the department did," later commented Ronning. In April 1949, Nanjing was liberated and foreign governments began to evacuate embassy staff. Among those who remained, Ronning was the only one fluent in Chinese. He became known as ambassador at large and acted as an interpreter for the remaining diplomats at the meetings with communist officials, among them Huang Hua, who later became China's first ambassador to Canada in the 70s. Throughout this period, Ronning shared the experience with Seymour Topping, the correspondent for Associated Press, who married his daughter Audrey in Camrose on the 10th of November, 1949. Ronning did not attend. He was still in China, in charge of the embassy since midsummer, when T.C. Davis, the ambassador, had returned to Canada. Both Ambassador Davis and Ronning urged Ottawa to recognize the new government in Beijing as quickly as possible. Ronning saw no advantage in delay. Ottawa, however, delayed. The Canadian Minister for External Affairs, Lester Pearson, was of the opinion that the new government should be recognized, but was not certain of the timing. In the Canadian Parliament, the CCF, Ronning's old party, urged recognition, while the Conservatives, the official opposition, were against it. Questions were raised as to how completely the new government was in control of China and of how independent it was of the Soviet Union. Was Chinese communism just an offshoot and puppet of Russia? The Liberal government delayed, noting that Indian and British efforts to recognize Beijing had met with some obstacles. At this time, the opinion in the United States was not a factor because there was some reason to think that the U.S. would recognize the new government. From January 1950 onwards, the American position on China began to harden against recognition. Ronning continued to press for permission to begin talks, and in the spring of 1950 was asked to explore China's response to a possible Canadian position, which, in essence, was to seek assurance in advance from China that there would not be the difficulties that Britain and India experienced should Canada go ahead. China responded that it could not guarantee in advance the conditions of something that had not yet been formally proposed. Canada hesitated again, and by May 1950, Ronning was embarrassed as Canada's representative. He felt that any goodwill on the Chinese side was in danger of being dissipated. In anticipation of a positive instructions from Ottawa, Ronning in June went to Beijing to look for housing. By the 27th of June, the cabinet had almost decided, but it adjourned without a firm decision. In anticipation, instructions were prepared for Ronning, but they were never sent. Later in his life, Ronning was of the opinion he had actually received them, but the records show otherwise. Conflict had broken out on the Korean Peninsula. Canada's full diplomatic efforts were put into the UN's attempt to settle the Korean problem. Matters got worse when China entered the war and was branded an aggressor by the United Nations. Ronning remained in China, but in January 1951, he was told to close the embassy. He lowered the flag on the 26th of February and returned to Canada shortly thereafter. The Consul General in Shanghai remained open for another year. Ronning had pushed himself to the edge of exhaustion. Indeed, the previous July, the department expressed concerns for his health. Ronning experienced similar exhaustion in 1927 after he and his family made an emergency evacuation from Fanshan under extremely difficult conditions. And again in 1942, at the end of his numerous bids for elected provincial office and direction of CCF activities in Alberta. This time, he had been in China for just over 5 years, without leave. He had some on the way back to Ottawa to take charge of the Far Eastern section of external affairs. Ronning's feelings on his impending departure were expressed in a letter to his family dated the 24th of January, 1951. Quote, "This will be the fourth time I have left China, and each time has been more or less associated with the most important events in Chinese recent history. The first time was just as the Boxer Rebellion was breaking out. The second was prior to the revolution that established the Republic. The third was at the climax of the Great Revolution." He's talking about the Northern Expedition. "The fourth is during the period when the new People's Republic is in conflict with the United Nations in Korea. The dates 1899, 1907, 1927, and 1951. It has just occurred to me that each stay here has been 6 years, nearly a quarter of a century altogether. I leave here with a heavy heart because I have not been able to accomplish that for which I have been working and waiting all this time, recognition of the real government of China." Back in Ottawa, Ronning headed the American and Far Eastern Division, but in 1952 the division was divided in half, with Ronning in charge of the Far Eastern section. During the Korean War, he was an essential part of Canada's diplomatic efforts, which were directed towards containing the conflict and toward urging the United States to restrain other ambitions that its policymakers might have vis-à-vis China. Ronning later wrote, "In my view, Canada's performance in the General Assembly of 1952 and in subsequent negotiations, principally with the United States, to get an armistice in Korea in 1953, illustrates how a middle power can be effective in dealing with international crises which otherwise could lead to world war." Ronning continued to remind the department of his promise, their promise to post him to Norway, the land of his and his wife's parents. In 1954, he went to Norway for a three-year term as Canada's ambassador. But a funny thing happened on the way to Oslo. Peace conferences in Geneva on Korea and Indochina broke out. Ronning was named deputy head of the Canadian delegation under Lester Pearson, the Minister for External Affairs. He assumed the leadership in Pearson's absence. The Korea conference began in April and ended in June in a stalemate, while the Indochina conference continued late into July until an armistice agreement was reached and international supervisory commissions established. Ronning was very active at Geneva. He chatted often with the Chinese delegation led by Zhou Enlai, and he took the opportunity to introduce Lester Pearson, the Canadian minister, to Zhou. It was when Zhou was talking to Pearson in a side room off the conference hall that John Foster Dulles, the American Secretary of State, appeared in the doorway. Zhou moved forward, his hand extended, but Dulles turned on his heel and left. Whether or not it was intended as a snub, it was seen as one by those who observed the event. One of the observers was Ronning, who referred to the incident frequently. In later years, he would say that Dulles shook his fist at Zhou, but none of the other accounts of the incident mentioned this. Ronning was also able to use his relations with Zhou to facilitate the release of a Canadian airman, Squadron Leader A.R. McKenzie from Calgary, who was shot down over North Korea and taken prisoner by the Chinese. The case was unique because Canada was not participating in the air war in Korea. McKenzie was on an exchange with the American Air Force and found himself fighting in Korea. Ronning's argument to the Chinese premier that it was a special case proved effective, and Squadron Leader McKenzie was released. Ronning was also friendly with the Indian delegation. His leader, Krishna Menon, said later, "I used Ronning, or rather Ronning used me." Ronning's relations with the United States delegation were not so friendly. The Americans were suspicious of Ronning because of his relations with the Chinese. Ronning's high profile at the Geneva meetings most certainly was a factor in the choice of Canada, along with Poland and India, as members of the three international commissions for the supervision and control of the three countries of Indochina. It came as a complete surprise to those members of the Canadian delegation who were on their way home by ship, and an absolute shock to the Department of External Affairs. It was said that Zhou suggested Canada and that the United States could scarcely object. It was speculated within the Department of External Affairs that it was Ronning's good relations with Zhou Enlai that led to the invitation for Canada to serve. Ronning, quote, "Ronning makes no mention of this in his memoirs," writes a historian of the department, "and seems never to have spoken to anyone in the department about it. In any event, he has much to answer for. Staffing the Indochina commissions became the single biggest administrative and personnel problem the department had to face during the next 20 years. Arthur E. Blanchett, who wrote these words, was a fan of Ronning since 1953, when he had been assigned to work in the Far Eastern Division. He gives a charming description of Ronning's style. Quote, "On Monday morning, I duly reported to the head of the division, Chester Ronning. I did not know at the time, but I was extraordinarily lucky. He was one of the most outstanding men under whom I would have the good fortune of serving. knowledgeable, kindly, approachable, friendly, helpful. I remember to this day how not long after my arrival in the division, he handled my first memorandum to the minister. He must have noticed that I was nervous when I brought it to him for consideration. He leaned back in his chair, rested his feet on his desk, and said, "Arthur, read it to me." I proceeded to do so with some trepidation. He listened intently and said, "Arthur, that's fine. Give it to me." And he signed it then and there. He had won a friend for life. Until Ronnie went to Norway, the Canadian mission there had been a legation, not an embassy. True to its word, External Affairs raised the post to an embassy in time for Ambassador Ronning to present his credentials the 10th of August, 1955. During his short term as ambassador to Norway and Iceland, Ronning was involved in NATO issues and had little to do with Asia. He was very aware, however, of a plan in 1956 for Canada to recognize China. It was still born because of an emotional response from President Eisenhower, who threatened that the United States would withdraw from the United Nations and kick the UN out of the country. The President's response was big news, and the Camrose Canadian of the 4th of April, 1956, ventured an editorial opinion. In part, it said, "Red China has a lot of internal house cleaning to do before decent people can be expected to accept her on equal terms. And it is not becoming for British and Canadian spokesmen to belittle the Eisenhower viewpoint till this house cleaning is done." After Norway, Ronning was posted to India as Canada's High Commissioner, well in time for the visit in November 1958 of Prime Minister Diefenbaker, who stopped in India as part of his 48-day world tour. He had long talks with Prime Minister Nehru, but when he asked Nehru about China, Nehru advised him to speak to Ronning. It had been said by Alvin Hamilton, who was Diefenbaker's Minister of Agriculture, and who made the first big grain deals in 61 with China, that Diefenbaker based his early China policy on the opinions of the fellows who ran the corner Chinese restaurant in Prince Albert. But it seems in 1958 he sounded out Ronning. Ronning had decided before the visit to avoid the topic of China, but as Diefenbaker requested it, he expounded his views. Ronning's views on China policy did not change throughout his time in External Affairs. He maintained that, contrary to American belief, Beijing was not a puppet of Moscow, that Mao's version of communism did not jibe with the Soviets, that Asian communism could not be defeated by military means, and what was needed was economic aid delivered in a way that it penetrated to the rice roots level of the common people. He mentioned to the Prime Minister the story of the attempt to recognize China in 1956 that was squelched by Eisenhower. Diefenbaker asked Ronning if he was absolutely certain of the date, and Ronning had it checked and reported to the Prime Minister the next day that the date indeed was accurate. Diefenbaker then revealed that a second attempt had been made early in 1958, only to have Eisenhower respond with even greater emotion. The memory of the Korean War and how American troops were fought to a stalemate remained strong in the minds of the American military, who, like the State Department, continued to view Beijing as part of the worldwide communist conspiracy. We know now that at this time Eisenhower gave his support to the training of Tibetan guerrillas in Colorado for dropping them back into Tibet equipped with American arms to fight the Chinese. The deal was made by the Dalai Lama's brother with the CIA, who also funded the Dalai Lama. No matter the possible repercussions for Canada of going against its powerful neighbor and biggest trading partner were too great. Once again, the initiative was dropped. With these two failed attempts went Chester Ronning's chances of returning to the land of his birth as Canadian ambassador. Ronning remained in Delhi until 1964, when age 70 he retired to Camrose. During his remaining years in Delhi, he was involved in negotiations surrounding Canada's sale of nuclear reactors to India, and with Canada's aid projects, one of these was named Ronning Town. At the same time, he was involved in conferences on Laos in 1961 to 62. Consequently, he was away from New Delhi during the border war between China and India, and affairs were in the hands of an acting high commissioner. Ronning's influence appears to be absent from the formulation of the Canadian response to the crisis. Canada and India were fellow members of the Commonwealth, but on the other hand, Canada had begun a series of lucrative grain deals with China. Initially, the Canadian government accepted completely the Indian version of events and sent aid which amounted to $6 million. It did not heed, however, the calls from some Canadians to divert to India wheat destined for China. By the time the war was over, many Canadians began to see the Chinese side of the matter. In 1964, Ronning and Inga retired to Camrose, where they lived in their modest white house. Inga died in 1967, and Ronning lived on his own with major support from his daughter, Sylvia Cassidy, until his final illness. His house contained a few souvenirs of his life abroad: the head of the tiger he shot in India, a huge scroll of horses by the famous Chinese painter Xu Beihong, and other items. Ronning was never a rich man, nor did he appear to have the ambition to be one. Throughout his life, he held positions of responsibility that brought him prestige and respect, but never large salaries. Although the diplomatic life provided some allowances for living and accommodation, they were minimal, and salaries, even for a high commission in India, were not lavish. Ronning had left the service before upward adjustments were made. Ronning and Inga had 6 children to raise, which must have stretched resources. Given his careers after 1932, one must conclude that Inga bore the major burden of child raising. In the decade from 1942 to 1952, Ronning was apart from his family for at least 5.5 years. Ronning's entirely unplanned and unexpected entry into the life of diplomacy led to a remarkable 20-year career. He had not sought diplomacy, it sought him. He said he had no training for the job, but I don't think the department has ever offered any. One learned as one climbed the ladder. Ronning, of course, joined the ladder halfway or more up to the top. Barely a decade after joining the Department of External Affairs, he was widely recognized as one of its giants. But even in retirement, he was not quite done. With the growing quagmire in Indochina and with the growing hostility within Canada to American involvement in Vietnam, the Canadian Minister of External Affairs, Paul Martin Sr., proposed that Canada undertake a constructive initiative. Convinced that Beijing held the key to a solution in Vietnam, he conceived of a Canadian mission to Beijing and Hanoi to explore the possibility for negotiations. Ronning, with his depth of Chinese and Indo-Chinese experience, was the ideal candidate. He undertook the mission, codenamed Smallbridge. He made 2 trips to Hanoi, one in March and one in June 1966, but Beijing refused to invite him, citing Canada's complicity with the United States on the International Security Commission matters. Ironically, the American State Department distrusted Ronning as well because they thought he was too pro-China. The famous Pentagon Papers indicate that the Secretary of State Dean Rusk and President Lyndon Johnson did not take the Ronning mission seriously. Ronning returned to Camrose, from which base he continued his fight for the recognition of China. Ronning, the private citizen, was free to engage in the debates over Vietnam, the recognition of China, and its seating in the UN. He was outspoken on these issues, condemning the American stance. He found a ready audience on the campuses of Canadian and American universities, where he participated in teach-ins and debates. Through television and radio interviews, he reached an even broader audience. His efforts and that of others primed Canadians for a change in Canadian policy towards China, implemented under a new Prime Minister, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, elected in 1968. Ronning's arguments carried a great deal of weight with Trudeau and with his foreign policy advisor, Ivan Head, a fellow Albertan and Ronning's friend. When on October 13, 1970, in the middle of the October crisis, it was announced that Canada and China had agreed on mutual recognition, Ronning was ecstatic. The business had been left undone in June 1950 was finally completed. He had no hope of being ambassador, but he could now return to the land of his birth to be welcomed by Premier Zhou as a valued old friend of China. Ronning returned to China with members of his family a number of times in the 14 years that remained to him. He was much honored in China and Canada. He published his memoirs, and a film was made of his life. He was made a member of the Alberta Order of Excellence and admitted to the Companion of the Order of Canada. He was awarded honorary degrees. He served on the Senate of the University of Alberta, his alma mater, and he gave guest lectures on modern China to students in universities and high schools. One evening, before a large audience at the University of Calgary, Ronnie gave a speech entitled, "Where is China Going?" He finished his talk and sat down when a student said, "But Mr. Ronning, you've not answered the question, where is China going?" Ronning stood up, walked to the microphone, looked directly at the student and said, "I don't know." Each ambassador from China to Canada called on Ronning. After all, they were old friends of 30 years, and he was a special honored guest at their banquets. He was a speaker at Gravenhurst in August 1976, when the house in which Norman Bethune was born was opened up as a museum. I was present at the ceremony, and I cannot resist describing the event. It was a beautiful day, and the opening ceremony was to take place around 1 o'clock to accommodate Otto Lang, the government minister who was to attend. On the grass alongside the old manse, where Bethune had been born, were rows of chairs facing a slightly raised platform and lectern. The front row of chairs was marked VIP, roped off for the Chinese guests coming from Ottawa by bus. Behind the house was a large caterer's tent filled with food and drinks to be consumed after the ceremony. I and a couple of national TV reporters loitered in the shade of a tree waiting for the event to begin. Ronning, Lang, the leader of the Chinese delegation, and perhaps one or two others were scheduled to speak. At this time of his life, Ronning was, when giving a speech, very easily slipped into a set piece, a long history of the Chinese Revolution, which could take up to half an hour or more. He had been told to stick to his written script. Time passed, and the crowd gathered, but the bus from Ottawa did not arrive. Otto Lang grew restless. He had a plane waiting to take him somewhere else. Some late visitors arrived, among them movie mogul Otto Preminger and hangers-on. He hoped to make a film on Bethune, and he saw this as an opportunity to discuss his plan with the Chinese officials. There were no empty seats, and Preminger, convinced that VIP meant him, sat down in the reserved row that soon filled up with his entourage and a few others. Still, the bus did not come, and the sun was assuming an angle such that it would soon shine directly in the eyes of the speakers. Finally, the bus arrived and disgorged the Chinese visitors. The driver had gotten lost. There were no seats for the visitors, who sat on the grass in front and at the feet of Otto Preminger. Matters got underway quickly. Lang spoke briefly, made his excuses, and fled. When Ronning stood up to speak, the sun was directly in his eyes. He could not see his script, so he launched into his account of the past of century and a half of Chinese history. The other speakers were brief, and in the absence of Lang, Ronning led the Chinese diplomats into the house for a tour. Meanwhile, the audience flocked to the tent, consuming all the food and drink. The organizers had not set aside any for the special guests. When they and Ronning exited the house into the tent, the pickings were very slim indeed. The Chinese guests were from the Canada section of the Chinese Foreign Office. They were good-humored about the situation, but I could not resist commenting to Ronning that this might have been their first experience of a real classless society. It was only a so-so day in Canada-China relations. Ronning's home also became a place of pilgrimage for visitors from China and a must-visit for the many Chinese students who came to study at the University of Alberta and other institutions. Ronning had an inexhaustible fund of stories about modern China and its leaders. Everyone listened with rapt attention and delight. Ronning, tall, distinguished, with a shock of silver-white hair and sparkling eyes, would recite rhymes in Chinese he'd learned in childhood, along with sayings from his home province. Everyone who visited Ronning left knowing that they had met a remarkable human being. Ronning, the diplomat, had an unorthodox career. He did not become a diplomat until he was 51, when he entered the Department of External Affairs in an exceptional way. The department needed someone who knew Chinese and the Chinese language, so Ronning was accepted at an advanced rank with no previous diplomatic experience. He adapted quickly, and within 9 years he was an ambassador. Because he did not spend years working his way up the diplomatic ladder, he seemed less constrained by strict protocol. A social democrat, he respected people but was never in awe of position. Trilingual and gregarious, he engaged everyone he met in conversation. Because he had family and family roots in the United States, he was perhaps less in awe of American power than many Canadians. In return, American policymakers distrusted Ronning. To accept his views would be to admit that America was a large part of the problem. Ronning's previous history as a leader of the provincial CCF party made him suspect in the eyes of members of the Canadian Conservative Party as well. In the stereotypes of the Cold War, they considered Ronning to be pink. In the opinion of one historian of Canadian foreign policy towards Vietnam, Ronning was one of the very small group of three who represented left-wing views within the Department of External Affairs. This opinion is perhaps borne out by the view of one of Ronning's fellow diplomats, an Australian, Sir Walter Crocker, who wrote, quote, "His government made some but not much use of his knowledge. In some respects, it distrusted his knowledge because it clashed with their policy or prejudices or with those of the United States," unquote. Today, 25 years after his death, Ronning is little remembered in Canada, although the Canadian Asia Pacific Foundation lists him as one of the 10 top people who influenced Canadian Asian relations in the 20th century. Sometimes China Mission, Tom Radford's NFB film about Ronning, appears on television, but apart from Camrose, where he lived and where he's buried, he is no longer well known. His name appears on a local school, and his house is used by Augustana, formerly Camrose Lutheran College, as its alumni office. More importantly, Augustana has created and named after him an active center that explores the nexus of faith and politics. Yet it can be argued that Ronning remains better known and his importance more widely recognized in China than in Canada or his home province. It is hazardous and foolhardy for a historian to speculate on what might have been, but I shall throw caution to the winds on this occasion. In my view, it is one of the tragedies of modern Canadian foreign policy, particularly with regard to Asia, that the government was unable to use Ronning's expertise to its fullest extent. No other Canadian diplomat in the third quarter of the century had the knowledge of Chinese politics, the connections, and access to the top leaders of the People's Republic. It is true there were many Americans who had what Ronning had, but in the paranoid excitement that marked the fall of China debate, the great American eagle ate its young. China experts within the U.S. State Department were either driven out or posted to Latin America under suspicion they were part of the great communist conspiracy that gave China to Mao. They knew, as did Ronning, that the Soviet Union and the Chinese Communist Party were at odds. After all, it was the Soviets who made a deal with Chiang Kai-shek at the end of the war to retain the old Imperial Russian concessions in China. It was Moscow that looted Manchuria of its industry as they withdrew their forces after entering the war against Japan in the final weeks before VJ Day. And the only ambassador to follow Chiang Kai-shek to refuge in Taiwan was a Soviet one. But this perspective was lost in Washington as it willingly put out the blinkers of the Cold War. A country whose Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, in 1956 could declare a panda unfit to enter the USA because it was a communist was not likely to open its heart to reason or logic. Nor did the United States destroy its own experts, but it reached across the border to attack Canada's. They scored a success with E.H. Norman when E.H. Norman was driven to suicide in 1957 by the continued accusations of the McCarran House Un-American Committee that he was a communist traitor. What is more, they effectively neutralized Ronning and any attempts to recognize China. Canada lacked the courage and resources to go it alone. At a conference in Banff on international affairs in August 1965, attended by External Affairs Minister Paul Martin Sr., the subject of recognition of China came up. Martin was pressed to admit that it was indeed American pressure that prevented Canada from going ahead. Martin, as was his style, displayed fantastic verbal footwork. He produced all sorts of other factors that played a role, and who could say which one was the dominant one? In the lounge after the question period, someone asked Martin's executive assistant, "If America recognized China today, how long would it take Canada?" 60 seconds, was the reply. It's true that Ronning's public crusade in the years after his retirement from the Foreign Service did much to sway public opinion towards recognition, and he had a direct influence on Trudeau and Ivan Head, who in any case needed very little prodding. It's also true that Ronning was a deep, subtle background influence on the preparations for Kissinger's mystery trip to China in 1971 to prepare for Nixon's grand entry in February 1972. But this was long after Ronning's best before date. His special missions to Hanoi in 1966 were his last opportunity, but without Washington's support, he was destined to fail. Of course, without Beijing's support, failure was assured as well. The problem was that Americans suspected Ronning would give an advantage to the Chinese, and the Chinese were worried that Ronning was an American plant. Ronning soldiered on and genuinely thought he had made a breakthrough, but Dean Rusk and LBJ were more or less of the view that he had been sucked in by the North Vietnamese, influenced by his socialist leanings. Besides, Canada had not stood with the U.S. in Vietnam, so why should they be allowed to meddle at high level? What would have happened had Ronning been made ambassador to Beijing in 1950? This was the time when Canada had a belief in the impact of world affairs that a middle power could have. It's nice to think the Canadian recognition of China would have helped diffuse American suspicions of China and vice versa, but would it have been able to stop the American trade embargo of China and China's reluctant decision to lean to one side and to accept assistance under miserable terms from the Soviet Union? Probably not, because at the time there was not the support in Canada for recognition. It was advocated by some returned missionaries and others, such as university students, but it was not until the Diefenbaker grain deals that opinion began to shift. Opinion polls on the prairies were soon showing a majority in favor, but the same was not true of central Canada, particularly Quebec. According to Paul Martin Sr., it was the concerted propaganda effort by the Catholic Church in Quebec, following the lead given by the Vatican, that kept Quebecers doubtful about recognition. It was not until the Sage and the Quiet Revolution that the influence of the church began to wane. Then came Trudeau, but at a time when even Henry Kissinger had clued into the fact that not all was well between Beijing and Moscow, and an opening to China would be beneficial to the United States. In my view, Ronning, despite the adverse circumstances, had an impact on Canada-China relations far beyond that of any other Canadian in the 20th century. Others, such as James Endicott and Paul Lynn, had too much baggage. Endicott, because of his charges of American germ warfare in Manchuria and his acceptance of the Stalin Peace Prize, and Paul Lynn, because he had left Canada in the early 50s as a young student to participate in the Chinese Revolution. And in his return in 1965, he was too direct a pipeline to Beijing and too much of an apologist for the Cultural Revolution and Mao's policies. It seems incredible that these three persons, Ronning, Endicott, and Lynn, are now accused by the extremist of the extreme right-wing paranoids to have been a front for a giant international drug smuggling ring operated out of China through Montreal. The internet does wonderful things. One final question comes to mind about Ronning, and that is, was his view of the Chinese Revolution too rosy? Was he too willing to forgive some of the excesses of the Chinese Communist Revolution because of the ends it sought to achieve? Did he see it as attempting to do what he had tried to bring about in Alberta through the CCF, a non-capitalistic, classless, equitable, and social democratic society? I think the answer is a qualified yes. He most certainly was against violence, which he associated with the communist movements here in Canada, But he was attuned to the depth of animosity and the blood feuds that marked relations between communists and the nationalists in China, and to the untold misery inflicted on the majority by the grasping greed of the few who ran the government. He accepted Mao's dictum that you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. When he was 83, Ronning said that his experience in Alberta politics had greatly helped him to better understand the Chinese Revolution. His rhetoric when campaigning for the CCF in Alberta, talking about overthrowing capitalism and freeing the masses from economic oppression, certainly paralleled the rhetoric used by the Chinese Communist Party. And his understanding of a farmer-led movement like the UFA was similar to Mao's decision to substitute the peasant class for the working class as the vanguard of the Chinese Revolution. What would Ronning think today of the Chinese Revolution that has so fully embraced capitalism and which has begun to show some of the negative aspects that mark the nationalist regime? I suspect he would be disappointed at the growing gap between urban and rural life in China, as he would be with the growing gap between rich and poor in Canada. And I think he would warn both countries that they run the risk of great social and economic disorder. At the same time, I am sure he could not help but be proud of how high the country of his birth has risen in the world. And I'm certain that he would be tickled to know that his home province of Hubei in China has recently twinned with his father's home county of Telemark in Norway. Thank you very much.
So are there questions and comments for an eminent expert who can answer all questions running?
I can give you repeat Ronning's 20-minute history.
Yeah,
Chinese Revolution.
Exactly.
The thing with Ronning, as he grew older, he looked so distinguished and mature and old that they thought he actually was there in the 1850s. And what he was describing was something he'd seen. But, he was terrific. He came to my classes to give lectures, and he just had everybody eating out of his hand. He was just terrific. And I was at the back of the hall the night that he failed to answer the question, where is China going? Just wonderful.
I had a question on the Hanoi mission. Didn't the U.S. government actually request initially
no.
then?
No.
Okay, that's the impression or how the story has been told.
No, that's not the story. No. It was the scuttlebutt was that Paul Martin Sr. was angling for a Nobel Peace Prize, and he was looking for something that would, it was a Canadian initiative, but they thought that that Ronning would be able to get into Peking. And then they were disappointed when Joe and I said, sorry, we can't receive you at this time. Because at that time there had been a kerfuffle because one of the Canadian members on one of the commissions, supervisory commission, Blair Seaborn, was said to have been communicating regularly with the Americans and giving inside hope to the Americans. So that really fouled up the situation. So it was not... No, it wasn't at the behest of the Americans. I also might mention, the Camrose Canadian editorial about the Eisenhower's complaint in 56. They also had a similar editorial in 58 when Eisenhower rejected it as well, that we shouldn't criticize Mr. Eisenhower.
Yeah. I'm going to ask the best security department in the office that we can.
Yeah. It's very, very difficult because, as I was mentioning to some people earlier this evening, I met her twice. She was a very reserved and quiet lady. And I couldn't get much out of Ronning himself on this, so I made my comments tonight about what I thought, that she had a burden of raising the children. She must have been, I just can't imagine, a young girl from the prairies going to China in 1921 to Beijing with one baby and then having two more in very primitive conditions up the Han River and Fangchen, and then coming out under those terrible conditions. And I rather gathered from Ronning's one or two things he said at that time that there was great tension within their relationship as a result of all that. Because he was going back to China. He was going back. Oh, he could move wherever he wanted. He could speak and all that sort of business. And although she was learning some Chinese with him, she was didn't have that facility. That's why I think he kept insisting when he went back to China in the embassy that they come out, the family come out. And he says at one point in his memoir, when External Affairs offered him the opportunity to go to China in 1945, it was Audrey and Kieran or someone who said, "Oh, great, let's go. So he figured there was some family backing for that. But then he also has made it very clear to me that everything was okay. Inga would put up with things as long as they were going to go to Norway. But again, it was kind of short, but still. I don't know enough about her, except that she seemed very reserved and enjoy her painting, and she won prizes with her painting.
You mentioned something about the connection with Canada, middle.
Yeah.
In the end, did Canada just have any impact on the American?
I think their impact as a middle power really came within the Korean Conference and the peace that was worked out in the Korean Conference. On the American attitude towards China, yes and no, because I say no because it was only when a super pragmatist, to put a polite word on it, like Henry Kissinger, made a decision. It wouldn't have made any difference who had argued for or against before that. Once he made that decision, that was going to be it. And Kissinger took advice from no one. There's another story about Kissinger that when they went to China with Nixon in 1972, there's a whole lot of people went with Nixon. It was like an old Chinese tribute mission to China. And he took with him the dean of Chinese studies in the United States, John King Fairbank, who himself had come under criticism from the McCarran and American Activities Commission, and he was generally suspect on both sides of the Taiwan Strait. But anyway, he went, and they stayed in a place, a hotel or accommodation near the Summer Palace, which is like a donut, and there's a big central lawn and everything else. And it used to be called the Goldfish Bowl. And they were staying there. That's where most of them were accommodated. So Kissinger, with the press all around, Kissinger asked Fairbank one morning to go for a walk. So the press all reported Kissinger was consulting the dean of the China's studies, and he didn't ask him a thing. They were both old Harvard professors, and I heard from Fairbank's wife, he never mentioned China. He just wanted it to appear that he was consulting someone. So when you're up against that, it's not likely. When I said Ronning had a subtle influence under there, it was really through Seymour Topping and Audrey and the New York Times. And one particular dinner they gave and briefing people who were briefing Kissinger. And it was on sort of atmosphere and everything else. And then but it was after, the thing to remember is that although the United States Nixon went over and they signed the Shanghai Communique, they really didn't drop the tie with Taiwan. They really didn't say we recognize Beijing rather than Taiwan. It was a sort of a halfway house. And so in that interim period, the sort of things that Ronning was the entree with Audrey and the New York Times. They produced a book on it. But they went and in the period of ping pong diplomacy and everything else, they had an influence that way, because that famous picture that Audrey took, I mean, she had an exceptional access. Ronning was talking to Zhou Enlai, and then he said to him, you know, I have a very humble place in Camrose. You must come visit me and I'll cook you a meal. And Zhou Enlai just threw back his head and laughed. And Audrey took that picture and it became world famous. But it was putting a very human face on what before had been regarded as a regime that was out to kill your babies. And I think Ronning had a very important but subtle role played in that. But it was, I don't think he had any impact on Carter and Brzezinski, who made the final decision to recognize fully China in January 1978. That, again, was something that Carter and Brzezinski felt was due and had to be done, because China had been admitted to the UN in 1971, etc., etc. But, you know, in 76, the U.S. threatened to pull out of the Olympics in Montreal because of the China business. They threatened to do a boycott because People's Republic of China was going to be represented. And so, you know, it's a mixed, a very confusing and mixed thing. But the answer to your question is no, but subtly a bit. Well, Trudeau had been an early advocate of recognizing China because he traveled there as a young man in 1950. And he'd been all around, and he thought it was silly that it wasn't being recognized. And so he and Ronning certainly were of like minds, and in later years they met each other. They were talking off the same page. Ivan Head, when I said that somebody was pestering at the Banff conference, was pestering Paul Martin. That was when Ivan Head was still a professor at U of A, and he was raising, starting the questions and all that sort of stuff. And then, of course, he became, when Trudeau was Minister of Justice, he became part of Trudeau's entourage in justice, and then became his foreign policy advisor. So they were all on the same, pointed in the same direction. So I don't know that, except there was Ronning's influence. There was Bethune, and there was Ronning. So, and there was a lovely scene. Trudeau came to China in October 1973 to mark the third anniversary of relations. And Ronning was there visiting with the family, but he was out of town. And Trudeau had his final talks and everything else, and he was headed to the railway station to catch the train with Deng Xiaoping, and they were going south to do some touring. And Ronning came in off a train from where he had been, and so they sort of met in Peking Station. It was very nicely timed. Yeah. But I think that was serendipitous. I don't think it was actually planned. I think just timing was good.
You mentioned that Ronning had offered
several
doctors.
Yeah.
From which universities?
I can't remember them all. He had them in Calgary. He had them from Waterloo. I think he had one from U of A. And I think he may have had some from the States. I don't have a full list. I don't know whether he remembered them all either. But I think he gave Lethbridge as well. I think almost every university in Alberta gave him one. And then one's down east, and I think he may have had some from Minnesota. I'm not sure. That's something I'd have to check.
I have a husband heading on the next chapter.
Evan's retirement.
No. We need to pull over here.
Yeah. Well, it's nearly on the way.
On the way. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It was just amazing for us to get this very detailed glimpse into a fascinating life. So thank you very much.